Welcome. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education here at the Modern, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series that we are proud to offer for free, as you know, in the fall and then again in the spring of each year. Next week, we have the New York-based William Lanson. He will be here to share ideas behind his very lively and inventive work. I encourage you to go online and check out his website if you don't know the work. It's very inventive. It'll tickle you. You'll be sorry if you miss it. Also, come early so that you can go through the galleries. There's always a lecture a gallery lecture preceding the Tuesday evening lecture that's by a graduate student that's in our graduate lecture program, and they've been very interesting, very well prepared, and I saw that they had a big crowd tonight, so I hope you'll make it early for that. Also, come early. We keep the galleries open until 7 on these Tuesday evenings for your convenience, and I would like for you to be able to take the opportunity to spend some time with the upcoming exhibition, Susan Rothenberg, Moving in Place, which opens to the public this Sunday. Tonight's lecture being a very special preview of that exhibition. It is our great fortune to have Susan Rothenberg here tonight in conversation with our own chief curator, Michael Opping. Michael and Susan go way back with a relationship that runs deep and wide. In fact, I have here perhaps even earlier than Michael's days in Buffalo, but in fact I found out that it is quite a bit earlier than Michael's days in Buffalo. He told me that he was responsible for her first museum exhibition, which was a Matrix exhibition at Berkeley in 1978. But I do want to put the plug in about Buffalo, because I always have to mention that Michael came here from the Albright Knox in Buffalo, where in fact he had curated an exhibition of Susan's drawings and paintings in 1992. And I dare to say that Michael coming here from the Albright Knox was one of the best things to happen to the Modern and in return to Fort Worth. Michael's exhibition, Susan Rothenberg, Moving in Place, is stunning, with early to recent works that speak to Susan's enormous contribution to painting, including her reintroduction of the figure in the form of a horse, as well as her commitment to her own personal path. While not completely up to date, it is a range that is actually represented quite well in the museum's holdings, with the important early painting, Cabin Fever, from 1976. We have the somewhat wrenching Orange Break from 1989 that speaks to Susan's move from New York to Galisteo, New Mexico, and the violent but beautiful White Deer of 2001 that seems to be in the thick of the Galisteo experience. Susan's paintings take the viewer through the kind of experience you hope for with painting. It begins visually and moves to something more cerebral. You see it, you feel it, and then you think about it. And they seem to have been that way from the beginning. Peter Sheldahl wrote of his first encounter with Susan's work. Let me see if I can get this quote right. He's such a great writer. And he says, I was right, wrong, nuts, and inarticulate and sent when I saw three big, gawky paintings by Susan Rothenberg at the post-minimalist gangster alternative space 112 Green Street in the autumn of 1975. Those were laboratory days. The show was Eureka. And he goes on to say of Susan's paintings that an unsuspected reset button had been pushed. New game. As I understand, that was Susan's first solo exhibition, not her first museum exhibition, obviously. Born in Buffalo with a BFA from Cornell University, Susan's work has heralded as introducing imagery to minimalist abstraction and was included in the historically significant New Image painting show at the Whitney Museum of American Art in 1978. With grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, exhibitions that span the globe, inclusion in the 1979 Whitney Biennial, and then again in the 2007 Venice Biennale, just to show that she started early and she's still at it, and phenomenal public collections, Susan doesn't seem the least bit plussed by the business and politics of art. Based on interviews and the work, she evidently just stays at it because it's what she does. And the result is honest paintings that make us all want to take up a brush and paint our lives. As Johanna Burton wrote in an art form review of Susan's recent show at the New York Gallery, her New York Gallery, Speroni Westwater, sorry about that. One can see Rothenberg's work, a commitment to staying the course, undaunted by, though obviously aware of, whatever conjectures are made, then or now, about the medium's relevance or trends. Something that certainly rings true in the paintings that Michael has chosen for Susan Rothenberg Moving in Place. I think it is clear that we are all the beneficiaries of Michael and Susan's relationship as curator and artist, and as a result, as friends. So without further delay, please join me in welcoming Susan Rothenberg and Michael Oppenheim.
Let's go do it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Terry. Let me preface this by saying that I haven't allowed Susan to see what I'm going to show tonight. Over our 30 years of friendship, we like to keep the surprises coming. So, and hopefully it'll make for a more interesting dialogue. And so I'll get right into it. If we could bring the lights down. Susan, now you got to turn around so you can see what I'm showing here. And talk about some of those early horse paintings. And I think it's important
for some... Bad slide.
Bad slide. I know it's a bad slide. It's a great painting, bad slide. I should have shown her these beforehand. I wouldn't get this kind of grief. For those of you who weren't walking around New York in the early, mid-1970s, you have to understand what it meant to walk into a gallery and see this. These were really smart, dumb paintings. Dumb in the sense that you couldn't believe, Susan, that someone had done a horse painting, particularly when everything else around you was abstraction. And so I guess my first question to you would be, how did you come up with the idea of painting a horse?
There's your first singer.
There's my first singer. But just get through the zinger and
okay. There's possibly several influences. At the time when I moved to New York, I was 25 years old, and I was quickly inducted into the keep it flat mode. No illusionism, please, in our art world, and please, hardly any painting at all after abstract expressionism. So I was working for Nancy Graves. I was a slave in her studio, mixing marble dust and wax and working on her camel legs. At that point, she was an artist that stuffed camels. She recreated camel shapes and forms, and they were her sculpture, the camel. And by then, she had disassembled it and was working with camel legs, and she had a bunch of us young wannabes working her studio, and I think that was probably clutching onto this forming of the interior of the shape of camel legs and camel forms was influential. Second influence, obviously, Jasper Johns. I knew I wasn't an abstract artist.
Oh. We know each other way too well. Go ahead, keep going.
But I wanted paint to really be paint. I wanted a form relating to nothing that I was particularly close to. I'm not a horse girl. I did a little bit of riding when I was a kid. And I wanted to think about a very low color palette and what happens when you geometrically bisect and divide a natural form.
Do you think that for a generation after about 1945, that it was even possible to make a figurative painting without referring to abstraction for an American artist? Not Europeans, but for an American artist.
And I have to tell you, Michael, and you probably know this, that I don't think that way. I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't pose that kind of question to myself. I did a almost cave-like drawing. It looked okay. I blew it up to about 5 by 7 feet. The first little painting of a horse was about 16 inches by 12 inches. I don't have that kind of theoretical, analytical mind. I knew that I learned to keep it flat. I learned that I like paint to be fat and thin and all the way the paint could be. So I can't answer that.
Yeah.
I just can't.
Did you? Yes.
Can I ask that Susan move over there?
Sure. Why don't you come over here, Susan? So, yeah, that's a good idea. You've talked about Frank Stella before, and the question about abstraction was that, you know, when you and I came into the art world, abstraction was what was going on.
Yeah, and minimalism.
And minimalism, abstract minimalism. And so I guess the question that I was asking about abstraction was that, you know, there was a certain group of artists, and you were a pioneer in it, who were deciding that they could make figurative paintings, but they also had to refer to a certain history in American art, respecting your elders in a certain way. You were kind of respecting Johns and respecting Stella at the same time being a bad person.
Yes, yes.
Right? A bad
yeah.
girl.
Yeah. The real no-no was a human figure.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody said anything about horses. But God forbid, except for Philip Perlstein, you should try a nude. Mm-hmm. But Stella was a huge influence, and his paintings, many of his paintings are mesmerizing to me. Not because of the dazzle, not because of the low tone. We've skipped a whole bunch of paintings here because he was a very minimalist palette. And when I decided to use color, I decided to use it in the most basic way possible. But I'm sorry, but I think I flubbed your question.
No, you didn't. And I'll just continue a little bit with this slide comparison. When I first saw Four Color Horse, which is a painting from 76. Four Color Horse is from 1976. When I saw Four Color Horse, I thought, here is someone who wants to paint the figure but is camouflaging it at the same time. The reason I put this slide comparison up is because one of the things Stella did was he made the edges of the painting. There was a radial action to Stella's abstraction, mm-hmm. that was very important, mm-hmm. that made you aware of the thing as an object and as a painting and an object. And Four Color Horse has the same radial quality. You would take it in a completely different direction, but that's the reason for this comparison.
Right, no, and it's a good comparison, and there was a strange attraction, as later, if you have any of those works, that there are a very strong attraction to Mondrian. As in opposites attract. But yes, the last thing I wanted to do was lose my edges. I wanted to make the painting a complete thing. I didn't want it to be an object and then a wishy-washy ground or something. I wanted the painting to stand as an object.
Did you want, in terms of color, were you looking for atmosphere? Or for a frontal, an issue of color coming out at the viewer? Or did you want color to recede? Or did you want to keep it ambiguous?
None of the above. This painting actually refers to some book that I was reading that referred to, oddly enough, New Mexico, sand paintings. East being south, red being, whatever there.
Right.
You know, red being east, yellow being south, white being north, and black being west. It was a certain mythology and a certain tribe that I don't remember. So color meant only that to me in this painting.
Okay. Okay, come on. Oh, there we go. So one of the things that I learned in the show, and I thought I'd learned just about everything, that I could learn about your paintings was that in the very early days, you painted off the floor.
Yes.
It didn't occur to you that you could get by a table.
Right.
And put your paints on a table.
No. I mixed on the floor. I dripped and mixed. If a white was too white, I'd find some big black drips and raw umber drips and red drips. And yes, Eric Fischel used to laugh his head off at my... He still asks me, do you still paint off the floor, Susan? But now my tables all look like...
Like the floor.
Like the floor.
But yes. One of the things that interests me about that is that it makes the fact that you're painting off the floor and moving back and forth from the canvas, it actually makes the process of painting even more physical.
Yeah.
You know, it's a physical act. It becomes more like almost like a sport.
But I found it, you know, it was not pleasant to paint out of tubes squeezed onto anything. I mean, I would take a tube and squeeze it on the floor if I found a color that I liked from my previous strips. Then I would bring turpentine and stuff over. And but yeah, I was pretty much wading through the shit.
Well, and it brought a certain primitive energy, you know, to your pictures too.
I mean,
it's like your paintings always look like they're made by hand. I mean, they look very much handmade. And then we'll go through this last bit of influence. And I know that you were looking at the caves, images of the caves of Lascaux, France,
yeah,
which were 16,000-year-old paintings on cave walls. And that I can't believe that the horse image didn't come a little bit from that. I don't know what
I forgot to mention it, but for sure. And also from one other thing that I didn't say, but these are so beautiful. They're so elegant compared to my work. But one thing I also mentioned that I had been at the beach all day at Coney Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I was driving home, and I had, you know how when you've been at the beach and there's the water and the sun and everything is sort of just the same color almost. It's not blue or white, the sand and the sea anymore. And I wondered as I was driving home, what if the telephone poles and the houses and the ground and the road were all the same color? And that's another influence that I determined that. And then my only trouble was, how do you make a differentiation with edges without making too strong a point of edges, the horse and the ground? But it was a post-beach flash. But yes, the Lascaux paintings just blow me away.
And the other thing about the early horse paintings that has always fascinated me is this shadow image. It's like a doubling of the image. And I have my theory about what it means to me when I look at it, which to me, it created a slight blur, a dissonance that created a certain energy and sense of movement to the pictures that they wouldn't have had if they were just a simple profile, exactly. A single profile.
Yes, but at some point I discovered it takes three, I don't know what the word is, three things to make a painting. You got your figure and you got your ground, if you're a figurative painter. And then it seemed to me that I needed a third thing. And the third thing was the... What would you call it?
I see. An intermediary space.
I was going to say intermission.
Oh.
intermediary between the figure and the ground.
Aha.
And then that could be as important as the figure and the ground.
Interesting.
And in most of my paintings, you'll almost see 3, 5, 7. I don't know why, but there's almost nothing with 4, 6, 8. Parts.
That's interesting.
An odd number, but it came from knowing there's a figure, there's the ground, and there has to be the other. And the other would become many things in many different paintings.
Oh, I thought I was finished with the influences, but I'm not. Sorry.
Okay.
So
I had Moy Bridges' book.
Yeah, and you had Moy Bridges' book. So, you know, and what really fascinated me was that this is our painting, Cabin Fever. 1975. And if you look at, you know, and everyone knows the story that Leland Stanford hired Muybridge to photograph a horse running to prove that a horse, at a certain point in his gallop, all four legs left the ground. And he hired Muybridge. It took him, I guess, was 4 years to set up all of these cameras, and he did prove that the horse's legs leave the ground. You can see right there, there, and there. And our painting, Cabin Fever, is almost like you were, at this point, really looking at Muybridge. It's like the sense of this giant hulk floating on the Siena ground. But again, with this shadow space.
I flipped through him. I've never worked from anybody else or from photographs, including Muybridge, but I'm sure that it soaked in.
Unconsciously.
Yeah. I mean, I've never wanted to work from anybody else's images.
And I don't mean to suggest that you actually looked at this set of...
No, but I'm sure it soaked in because I was fascinated, and at a certain point I realized how awkward and crude my horses were.
And
I must have looked for verification of what it could do, how it could move.
Mm-hmm.
Once I got into, I mean, there were many paintings that we're not looking at that were
right.
that were pretty static.
Well, ours is just like galloping at full speed, the Cabin Fever, which, an ironic title, it's like it's stuck inside the confines of the edges of the picture. And
that's what I thought too.
It wants out.
Yeah. But also, you know, your title for this show, Moving in Place, is perfect.
It is. It came actually from looking at this picture. And although this horse this horse also is the first time I noticed, at least in my mind, this circular motion that occurs in your pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the horse is moving, and then you have this line running down the center to stop it.
Precisely.
To deny it.
The tension. I also think that that's maybe the fourth thing that every painting should have.
Tension. But
try to figure a ground. And a third thing, a painting has to have tension.
And for those of us who've looked at a lot of Susan's paintings, a lot of people, when they see the horse paintings, they may see a classic horse painting like Cabin Fever, and there are others, Flanders. All great sort of iconic works, but there's this whole series of horses that are very human-like. I mean, they're awkward. This one's falling down. I mean, this one, you know, I mean, this one's actually making a mistake. It's stumbling, you know. And it gives, to my mind, it's always given your early horses a human quality. Rather than...
I never thought of that.
Like this big, bold horse quality. Well, I'm taking this somewhere, and this is where I always take it.
Okay.
And I always love, when I lecture on Susan Rothenberg, at least a third of the way through, I have to show this slide. Because it's one of the most absurd paintings I've ever seen in my life. It's a horse wearing a white bathrobe, is what it is. And I stared at this for the longest time when I was doing Susan's retrospective in the early 90s, wondering, what's going on here? And I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's like the horse in the high school play. You know, where there's a bunch of people stuffed inside the horse, and the horse gets on stage, and everybody sort of thinks...
No, I wondered what would happen if you obscured the horse pieces. It's a medieval dress.
Medieval dress, I see.
Yeah, but you're not very wrong for this stage.
It's called White Robe.
White Robe, yeah.
Is what it's called. And so you've...
But I thought, like, how recognizable is this much-used image of mine if its body is not fully exposed and it's just a medieval horse dress shape?
It's you still have this painting, right?
I think I do. I think
yeah.
I still
oh,
have
you never
it.
Sold that.
No. No. Unfortunately, I think I showed
I'm
it.
Kidding.
But I'm quite fond of it for just, you know, yeah. What you covered the thing up, and it's is it still a horse?
Exactly. And
right.
that's is
as far
the mystery.
As we need to go.
That's true. But I was thinking...
You're embarrassing me.
No, I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, shoot. This thing. Okay. So then, if you go to the, you know, you have white robe, this horse that's obscured and hidden, you don't know what's under the white robe. Then you look at these test photographs that you did